Hello and welcome back to the Jersey Ontario podcast. Finally, our producer took some time off this summer. He's just getting back to work now. We've got a great show coming up for you today. I talk with Scott Verseth of Fressel Farm about his transition to milking Jersey cows, and we chat with Larry Sheardown, looking back at his long and storied career in the Jersey business. Before we get to any of that, I thought I'd take a couple of minutes and introduce myself properly. Somebody mentioned to me that for any listeners who don't know who I am, they might be wondering about this random guy who's hosting the show, so that's a fair point. I farm with my brother Andreas and my mom Pligitte. We milk 45 cows in a single Gia robot on a cows are on a pack. We crop about 500 acres as well. I manage the dairy side. My brother manages the crop side. Mom looks after the bookkeeping. But at the end of the day, we're all pulling on the same rope and working together. I graduated from the animal science program at McGill University in 2011. I did graduate work at Université Laval in Quebec City after that. I do have a master's degree from my work on milk fat. I've been on the Jersey Ontario board since 2017, which has been quite an enjoyable experience. I also sit on the genetic evaluation board at Lactinet as the representative for the Jersey breed. My wife Alexia is a family physician. She practices at our local clinic. She also does some emergency room work in Perth. We have four kids. Jakob will be seven soon. Reinhardt is five. Teo is three. And our baby girl Ina will be one on Halloween. The podcast came up on Jersey Ontario's radar a few years ago, and this winter I thought I wanted to tackle the project. It is a little bit more time-consuming than perhaps I had envisioned or hoped, but it is quite an enjoyable experience. I particularly like doing the interviews. I would really encourage listeners to provide feedback, whether it's suggestions on future episodes or comments about something you've enjoyed. It's really hard to gauge the value of the podcast to listeners and membership without listener input. If I don't hear from you, I don't know what is going well, what's not going so well. You can do this by giving the show a rating or a review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Comment or message us on Facebook. The Jersey Ontario page will have a file shared every month with that month's episode. You can also email us, jerseyontariopodcast@gmail.com. And if you are enjoying the podcast, please, please share it with a friend or even two or more. The more people listening means the better chance of us finding a sponsor, which in turn makes the show more viable in the long run. Thank you for your consideration. All right, enough about that and on to the good stuff. First up today is my conversation with Scott Verseth. Joining me now is Scott Verseth. He owns and operates Fressel Farm with his mother Sylvia just outside of Brockville. They moved to the current location in 2011 after previously farming in Williamsburg. The first Jersey cow joined their herd in October 2020, with that last Holstein leaving their herd in December 2022, making them an all-Jersey herd now. I've asked Scott to share his experience about the transition to the Jersey breed and to learn a little bit about his life story. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how it came that you guys ended up just outside of Brockville.
Okay, so my parents immigrated from Switzerland in 1983 to Williamsburg, where they bought a property with 150 acres and about 30 cows. And there wasn't much expansion at the time, so it kind of stayed that way until the boys, I've got an older sister and two younger brothers, and there wasn't very much interest in the farm at the time. I would do the work that was needed, and my two younger brothers would help a little bit here and there. And once we were done high school, I actually went off to do a one-year course at Fanshawe College for Police Foundations. I did not have that much interest in farming. So my dad kept holding off. And one day while I was in London, I finally realized I started missing cows. So I went to work at London Dairy for the night milkings every once in a while. And ever since then, I got interested in farming again full time. I finished my year in London. The next year, I went to Kempville to do a two-year program at University of Guelph Kempville campus, and graduated in 2009. And we finally, my parents knew I was fully interested in the farm, so we slowly started looking at what we should do, is if we should renovate our tie stall barn that had 50 stalls, if we should make them small or make them larger to fit our Holsteins, and if we should keep going that route. But one of the issues we had out in Williamsburg area was there was 15 farms, dairy farms, that were around 15 years prior. And once we had sold, there was only two left in the area. So there was a lot of people that sold out previous, which meant land prices were going outrageously high where we weren't able to compete. So we decided to start looking for a farm, and luckily enough, found one in Brockville, just 5 minutes north of the 401. We bought this place in 2011, my parents and myself, and we started milking 70 cows right off the bat, and we had 350 acres. So we basically doubled our land mass and doubled our quota holdings.
Wow, that's quite a jump, right? Kind of overnight.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your farm now. I mean, we're, 12 years past that move?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the cows, your milking setup, and the cropping situation as you guys have it now.
So in 2011, we started out, and we showed up. The herd that was here, we brought our best cows from Williamsburg that we could, and we were milking about that 80 cows. There was 85 stalls in our barn, and we were milking in a double six parlor. And ever since 2011, there's been quite a bit of changes. We slowly started going more the land side. So we ended up buying a little bit more land in the area as it was reasonably priced. So we were up to about 600 acres of land and still milking around the same animals. And later on, the years kept going by. We kind of kept seeing that the barn was kind of an issue with the cows. We had bigger Holstein cows, and the barn is it's a free stall with the stalls are against the wall. It's just a two row and the stalls are against the wall. And our problem was our cows just weren't lasting. The from the very end of the stall to the wall, we had 7.5 feet, and the cows just destroy their backs, destroy their legs. So we were getting the hoof trimmer in every 2 to 3 months just to keep up on maintenance on cows. And it was becoming a problem more and more as I see it. I tried breeding a little bit more for stature, and I slowly started realizing that you just can't fix that overnight. And I remembered when we had moved to Brockville, it was a Jersey crossbred cow, a first generation crossbred cow. And she did her first lactation out in Williamsburg with us in the tie stall. She moved to the free stall here, and she had 9 lactations for us. And wow. I was like, holy smokes, like that's pretty impressive. Like that's a good hardy cow. She was a problem free. She'd get up nice and easy. She was never a problem. And that got me thinking a little bit. And a couple years down the road, we had to call her 1 year, well, her last year. And once we called her, I noticed that we only had big Holsteins again. So I slowly started dabbling in 2019 into breeding some of those monster cows to Jersey bulls. And the first couple of ones that we had, I was ecstatic. You get the nice brown color. They came out nice and happy. We calved them in, and they were basically a tall or a shorter Holstein. So the size was still a problem in our stalls. So that's where finally one day I decided we needed to buy some cows. I got a hold of London Dairy. I was able to get down there to check out a couple of cows, and we bought 15 of them. That was in October of 2020. We bought 15. Then we bought 25 weaned calves as well. And that was kind of the start of the transition. That's when we slowly started buying more Jerseys and selling off all of our fresh heifers, fresh Holstein heifers.
That was in 2020. I mean, that took basically 2 years now from that first batch of 15 Jerseys coming into the herd to December of 2022. So 2 years and a few months later, the last Holstein's gone. that's a huge switch, and it happened very rapidly for you. So looking at your kind of economic situation, how do you think that that massive change in your herd profile has impacted your bottom line?
Okay. Well, the thing that we've noticed the most, it's tricky to assess. I get the question asked a lot. It's tricky to assess just with the way the price of milk has increased the last 2 years. So the one thing we've really noticed is just the feed conversion. We were milking always that 70 to 80 Holsteins, and we always had to grow about that 1 acre corn silage, 1 acre of alfalfa to be safe, to have that extra month left of feed so we don't have to feed fresh every year. So every year since we slowly started transitioning from Holstein to Jersey, I mean, it's only been 2 years, but we've noticed we were 80 acres the first year. And the second year, I was like, oh my goodness, we still have almost a half bunk left over. So just in that sense, we're feeding, I'm quite confident in saying this, that we're feeding a third less forages for the same amount of quota filling.
And that's huge, right? Because now you have like a third more, you know, you whatever you're putting in there, beans or corn, that you're going to be able to sell as a cash crop, right? So there's some added revenue generated there, and you have a lot less work when it comes to corn silage time or haylage time, right? So now I also know that you guys put in robots 2 years ago. Tell us about that, because I think that's kind of an interesting story that might be helpful to some other people out there who are, you know, in a bind of one sort or another.
Yes, so we installed our two robots. We started milking with them in May of 2 years ago. And I've always liked the idea of robots, but the new robots for our facility, it was just priced a little bit high. I couldn't pencil it out. So we had a full-time hired guy who only had to take care of milking. We were milking three times a day. And we would do morning milkings, my mother and I, or my wife and I, and this employee would come in and he took care of the afternoon milking and the night milking. And he was great. Like, he was phenomenal. He took care of sick cows. He took care of everything. He was a great employee. Well, one afternoon he sends me a message saying, by the way, this is my last milking. I start my new job tomorrow. So you're sitting here thinking, oh dear, I'm going to have to start milking three times a day, find an employee, or speak about robots. So I actually called Dundas Agri Systems here in Brinston because we were actually looking at making the parlor a little bit bigger. We were a double six, and we were thinking, hey, let's, you know, we should be able to pound out another three stalls per side, so a double nine parlor. And that's when they threw out the idea of used robots. So we were able to go with two used robots for a very, very reasonable price that we were able to justify. So in January is when he gave us our, well, one day's notice. And in May of that year, we were milking in the robots already.
And that would have coincided with the time that the Jersey started moving in, right?
We were about a third Jersey at the time, yes.
So, I mean, we put in a single robot here 3 years ago now, I guess, and I've noticed that it had some really positive impacts on kind of our lifestyle and being able to spend time with kids. And you and your wife Candace have four kids, I think 3 to 7 years old, if about ballpark, right? And yes. Your kids are actually more or less the same age as my kids. We see you guys at the rink on Thursday nights to go skating together. How do you balance that, you know, aspect of raising really young children while also managing the farm and all the work that the farm has to offer, but also, you know, young kids, and they want activities, they want to do stuff, they need to go places. So how do you like that balance? How do you find it?
Oh, the flexibility of it is huge. I just enjoy it. One of the things that was eating me up when I was younger, when we first started having our children, we had three boys and a girl, and I was like, I enjoyed playing hockey when I was younger. I always thought, boy, how am I going to do it whenever we have to milk and the boys have hockey at 6 o'clock. The amount of times my father wasn't able to make my hockey was, it was unball. He basically never made it because somebody had to milk the cows. So that was eating me up for a long time. And just having that flexibility of, okay, well, I can either go to the hockey now and take care of the cows when I get home, or vice versa, or the other way around, where you take care of the cows before and the cows are still getting milked. It's such a huge thing. You don't have to hurry home. We're seeing it yesterday. We were chopping hay, or we were doing dry bales, and I got done at 7 o'clock at night. Well, I got home. Everything was done. The milking was done. I didn't have to worry about running home, milking the cows. If we didn't get done on time, the hay would have gotten rained on. Just that flexibility. The mornings I really enjoy as well. I get up now, I eat breakfast with the kids before they head off to the bus. I bring them to the bus, and then I can go take care of the cows at the barn.
Yeah, and that's very similar for us. Our kids are involved in some activities. My brother and his wife, they've got two girls who have their own activities, and we're able to kind of just figure it out, right? Like who needs to go where at what time, and you know, I'll do chores early or later, or you know, trade out with my brother maybe, and that milking idea that the cows are being milked, it doesn't matter. Like you can feed maybe an hour later just as long as they're not out, but you don't have to worry about, you know, coming in and the bags all being dripping and dirty and, you know, increasing mastitis risk or whatever because you were an hour and a half late for whatever reason. I want to talk a little bit about your actual transition to jerseys and the types of jerseys that you got. You bought them from a lot of different places and different farms. So you've got a mix of purebred jerseys and percentage cows in the Canadian Herd Book or JX's. Does this bother you? And furthermore, what is your approach to breeding down the road as to how you're going to select sires for these cows?
So yes, Eric, when we first started buying from London Dairy, there was a nice bunch of cattle there, and there was a lot of them that were a bit of a darker shade of black, and that kind of it intrigued me as I could see the production that they were doing in their parlor, and the price was a little bit better on top of that. So when you're buying 15, you don't want to buy every single one at $3,000 a head, right? So we were pretty happy when we were starting to see these prices. And yeah, when we started milking them in the parlor, yeah, we can see that these crosses seem to be milking a little bit better. So now we had a little issue with our older Holstein cows. We had a couple smaller ones that were really milking well, but that were or fourth, fifth, and sixth lactation. And my problem was I didn't want to just call them out. So what we started doing with them is we were using 100%, we were using Jersey bulls on those cows and getting JX1 crosses with them. And we started milking here. We have six that are milking now, and they're in the 10th percentile for production in our herd as first lactation animals. So I keep looking at it. I know that it rubs some people the wrong way, the JX part of it, but financially, these animals, they're paving the way for our herd, I find. Because one of the trickiest parts I found while trying to buy jerseys is trying to find an animal with high production. It's one of the hidden gems I find when you're trying to buy jerseys. We've been buying here for the last 2.5 years, and other than there's a couple liquidation or a couple auctions, farm auctions, complete auctions, and then there's the couple of the Jersey sales that happened in between, and there's a couple here and there, but rarely do people get rid of their 10th percentile best milking animals, right?
Yeah, it's a challenge, right? So you've got these JXs. It took you a little bit to figure out what that nomenclature meant. And, you know, you're relatively happy with what they're doing for your herd. So going forward, I'm curious to know, like, how are you going to pick sires? You're going to do you care whether they're JX sires? Are you going to try and pick purebred sires with the best production? And how much will your decision making process be influenced by whether a cow is purebred or not?
So the whole purebred aspect, that doesn't bother me one bit. Right now, kind of what we're doing for everything, we're breeding 100% sex semen in everybody. So we're using three different sire companies. We're using Select Sires. I really like how the high producing bulls, I just feel like they have the most production from Select Sires. I'm using ST Genetics, same idea. I like that idea from that Got Made bull, how much milk they're able to pump out. And the other company I'm actually using is Viking Genetics. The idea I got from Viking Genetics was they're supposed to be really high in components, not as much milk, but really high in components. So what I'm looking at is I have all these JX1, JX2 animals eventually, and I know that they're going to have the production because we were getting them from our 10 to 15,000 kilo Holsteins. So I'm going to try to balance that out. That's the one thing I've noticed with our JXs is I do find that the components do lack a little bit. They will get the Holstein trait from the semen.
Yeah, and they might lag behind a little bit. And I will say that just from personal experience, as you go forward, and we don't know what the DFO pricing policy might look like in, you know, 2 or 5 years. The one thing that we're striving for in our herd is trying to bump our SNF up. We're right now running around 1.9, but, you know, we have been in the last 2 years, we've been as low as like 1.78 at times. And so The one thing we're looking at is trying to get as close to 2 as possible. And in the long run, yeah, you breed for higher protein in your Jersey cows, but in the intermediate, we're also trying a little bit of a different strategy. We're actually using some shorthorn semen, not to have a herd of crossbred animals, but to have some animals to actually bump it up. So you're doing the reverse. You have some, you know, basically high water cows, and you're going to use the Viking Genetics to try and bump their components as quickly as possible.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of one of the things we look at when I'm looking at sires. There's a handy little tool on the US side of things on their US Jersey Association website, where you can cross-reference and compare every bull on every sire, every sire company. So yep. One of the biggest things I look at, I'm kind of pushing that. I'm trying to go every bull I use, I'm trying to get plus a thousand in milk, and that plus 100 in JPI.
Okay,
that's things that I've been looking at recently. The JPI thing is, it seems like it's the Jersey Profit Index, right? That seems to me that's one of the most important things. It's how much money is she going to bring to you?
No, exactly. Right on. So your Holsteins are gone. Do you miss anything about your Holsteins?
Yes. That's one thing, as I'm talking about 1,000-liter bulls, the high-end production of the Holsteins and the robots. When we had those couple, we had close to 25 fresh heifers. And when you're getting 60, 65, 70 liters after 30 months fresh, that's one thing that is a little different with the jerseys. Now I'm happy when I see 35 liters. That's one of my higher end jersey heifers. So yeah. The high end production is definitely one of the things that I miss with the Holsteins.
Yeah, I could empathize with that statement a little bit. We've never had Holsteins really, so I haven't seen those super high numbers, but I like high numbers too, so I get it. What's your favorite thing about the jerseys?
Oh, the jerseys, man, the list is endless. I try to make everything work in the barn where either my mother, who's in her 60s, and myself, where we can work alone. If we need to sort a cow, if we have a cow that's down, it's something where you don't have to rely on somebody to hurry up and come help you. So just to be able to help a cow, to push a cow if she's stuck, little things like that. Once again, their feed conversion, that's number one. That's one of the biggest things. the summertime. Oh, the summertime with Holsteins. As soon as we see start seeing 25 degree weather, well, you can start looking for more cows because you always know that your butterfat's going to crash. The health is phenomenal. That's one of the nicest things we've noticed with, I think it might be a combination of two things, of going to the Jersey and going robotics. We've treated three cows in 2 years and 3 months for mastitis. Like, it's been phenomenal. I didn't think it would be as good as it is. The size of the animal, of course, we actually redid our stalls here, where everything was at 48 inches and we were able to go down to 43 inches. So we actually gained 10 new stalls for the barn, which I don't think any farmer is going to be disappointed with.
No.
And the breeding is unbelievable. Like, we're using 100%. We're using 100% sex semen. And our conception rate is better than conventional semen and Holstein.
That's a good marketing tale that you just told.
Yes. I am going to throw something in there. There are a couple cons that we've been having a bit of trouble, I find, here since we started. The one thing that I found that is trickiest is finding nutritionists that knows how to balance a ration for Jerseys. That is one thing that we've been having a tough time doing. It seems like most of them are either in Western Ontario or don't have time. That's one of the trickiest things. And the other thing is being able to find them. Being able to buy jerseys has been one of the toughest challenges, as everyone you call, they'll have some, but in a month or two or this winter, or everybody's got animals to sell later on, just never when you need them. And that's one of the trickiest things with the jerseys. But in also saying that, I basically started from scratch. The people that have kind of helped me, I've been in regular contact with Al Cunnington. He's part of Jersey Ontario, and he's been a huge help. He's been able to get me in contact with a lot of people, things to look out for, people to deal with. So that's been enjoyable. I've also talked quite a bit with Tyler Hendricks, who got me looking at the whole production side of thing, the JPI, looking at bulls when we first started buying, because you don't have much choice whenever you're looking at jerseys compared to what you're looking at the Holstein proofs list. Also talking with Charlie Stewart, Joe and Don Gordon, Kevin Elsoff, and yourself, Eric. You guys have been, it's nice having good people to help out when you're starting a huge career change, really. That wasn't a small step that we made, and it was reassuring having really good help with the industry.
I think that's a thought that is echoed a lot, even when I started attending the meeting, is the support that's present in the Jersey community, and the positivity and the openness and welcoming nature of the community. So I'm really glad that you have been able to experience that as well. Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Eric.
You are listening to the Jersey Ontario Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Scott. Next up is Larry Sheardown, as we take a look back at his time in the dairy industry.
Joining me now is Larry Sheardown of Rexley Jerseys. The Jersey herd had been registered since 1912, when his great-grandfather James registered their first jersey. Larry was active on the farm alongside his parents, John and Helen, since 1980 until they sold the dairy herd in June of 2021. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Well, good to be here.
So I want to start off the interview by having you tell us about your prefix and the long history of your herd, because you guys have had cows for quite a long time and been very active in the Jersey community, and we would like to hear that history.
Okay, I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. So I'm fourth generation, all in York County, King Township area. My great-grandfather James had jerseys in 1912 near Bolton. My grandfather and grandmother, Hugh and Mabel, who had the Northview prefix, purchased a farm in 1935, about a mile down the road from the current Rexley. And they farmed there until their barn burned in 45. They needed another barn because they needed the feed, and purchased where the current Rexley is in 45, and owned both those farms for quite a bit. My mother and father were, and they just shipped cream, had some sheep and, you know, chickens and other things, but always registered classified jerseys, sold a lot of cows. There was some high-end cows that ended up in the States that, you know, and went out to BC that my grandfather bred. And then my dad, he was the one that stayed home on the farm. There's nine in his family. He was, the rest of them were truck drivers, and girls actually, there's a connection to Bowlesland jerseys, is my aunt, Aunt Ann. So, and, if you go to Englehart, there's another, the Plewellings are actually cousins of mine from Bowlesland. So there's other Jersey connections within our family as well. So mom and dad, John and Helen, married in 1957 and farmed on the place down the road. And then in 66, my grandfather wanted to retire. So dad and mom bought the home farm and herd from my grandfather, and proceeded to build a milk house and ship milk. Now, it was also the start of the Ontario Milk Marketing Board. So we did get, I guess I allocated at the time 15 kilograms of quota, maybe for 20 cows, enough for 20 cows. And but dad wanted to put 40 stalls, and the original barn was still had dirt floor. He had to, I spent many days shoveling cement and making the stable, and working as a 10-year-old kid, doing all the things that kids do on the farm. Working alongside my brother Brian and my sister Teresa, who was born in 67, to help mom and dad make the farm move ahead with, you know, building as we went ahead.
I mean, this is a good segue into your childhood, because I'd like to hear what it was like growing up for you and what set you on your path towards being a dairy farmer. And your parents, obviously, or your great grandparents already had jerseys. Were there other breeds present on the farm at any time?
No, we were always a purebred Jersey herd. My grandfather was as proud a Jersey breeder as you'd ever meet. And, you know, he was always proud of his Jersey cows, and it was never any other than other species, like she had a few sheep and things. But
now you were, you know, you said about 10 years old and helping make the concrete for your barn, and helping your parents, working alongside them to keep things moving forward. Were you involved with 4-H growing up? And were you guys already showing cows at that time too?
Well, actually, my dad went to a couple of shows, but there was a lot going on and he really didn't have time. And there was actually, it's funny, my sister there had their, posted a picture just this last week of a cow that was at Richmond Hill Spring Show. That used to be the big show where Edgley and a lot of the big herds, Mortsons and all of them would go. And I think we had a class winner, but there just wasn't enough time in his day to do that. We had some nice cows, I think, back in the day, but there was no time in his world to go to shows. And he hadn't had the 4-H background. So I did do a lot of 4-H, and my 4-H club was kind of a who's living in York County. Yeah, we, you know, our neighbors, and we were the little herd up the 8th concession, but our neighbors were, you know, the Oak Ridges Farms, Tannery Hill Farms, you know, Romandale, Bond Haven was just a little bit north of here. You know, Sunny Maple eventually, and that which would turn it, which and now Quality down the road. It was a who's who in terms of cattle breeding, and most certainly dominated by Holstein herds, and that was in our 4-H club. Joey Bagg and Edgley were our Jersey, the other Jersey guys, I guess, that we had to deal with. Back then, Tannery Hill was Guernsey before they were Holstein, the Schwartzes. So Tim Henshaw, the Schwartzes, Joey, the Winters, it was a pretty impressive group of 4-H'ers. When I look back at it now and our involvement, we laugh about that, but it was pretty cool that we were all involved, and a lot of us still involved in the industry. So 4-H was certainly a big driver. I was fortunate enough, they used to do a special dairy competition, to spend time with the late Dave Houck of Romandale, who was the manager at Romandale, and he took us on special dairy competitions. You know, those kind of guys, I learned from them. They were Holstein guys. And yes, you took a ribbon for being a Jersey guy. It wasn't a popular thing to be. Jersey cows were seen as cute little cows that didn't give a lot of milk. And it was a tough time when the milk board came in based on volume and not getting paid for components. It was Jersey cows were not worth very much. They were getting sold. And so to stick it out with jerseys was one thing that, you know, we knew we had to be better, and we did eventually get there. But yeah, it was a tough time through the late 60s, 70s, even into the early 80s before multiple component pricing to be a Jersey guy, to be a Jersey kid. You took a lot of ribbon and a lot of grief at university for being the Jersey guy.
And you said that you went to the OAC.
Yes, I went to Guelph in 76. And again, there were not a lot of Jersey guys there. So Joey Bagg was a 79 Aggie. Hank Bergfeld, Mountain Field, who passed away a while ago, but he was also there. Diane Gerald Ray actually went for a year to Guelph. It started the same time as I did. Steve Holmes. I was the first member of our family to even think about going to university. I mean, think they were all truck drivers and hardworking people, but going to higher education back then was like, why do you want to do that? What would you want to do that for? But I was a 65 student in high school. You wouldn't get in with that marks I got in, but I persevered and stuck it out because I wanted to do, you know, to be better and learn things. And I mean, 4-H, and then, you know, the next step after that was junior farmers and stuff.
So if we can maybe, I don't know what time this happens in your life, but tell us about meeting your wife and, you know, convincing her to marry a farmer.
Well, actually, her dad was actually a carpenter, but they always lived in the country, but more junior farmers. Which was we had back then. Junior farmers was a big deal. It was 10,000 junior farmer members in 1980. I was actually a provincial director. So Sue and I met in junior farmers at a dance, and you know, we dated. We were married in '83, so you know, along the way. So
now, if I have this right, you have three kids.
Two, a boy and a girl. So I have Kyle and Elise. Kyle's 35, and went to Humber for police foundations, and now drives a delivery truck for Leon's, lives in Barrie. And my daughter Elise is 33, and Kyle has a boy. He's a year and a half, Oliver, and Elise married a farmer, even though his mother wondered what she was thinking. But Lockmar Holstein's a two-time master Holstein breeder. They have, Lisa and Andrew have two boys, James and Wesley. They're 7 and 5. So they milk 80 cows, have 20,000 broilers, and farm 1,000 acres, the Lockies. But, and they did get some Rexley heifers when we sold, went up there. And now they have two milking Rexley cows in their Holstein herd. So that was a lot of fun to actually be the first jerseys into a two-time master Holstein. And we've known Jim and Carol, the Lockies, forever. The kids actually, Elise and Andrew, we have pictures of them as one-year-olds on the kitchen floor. We were Sue and Carol, Andrew's mom, were best friends in college.
That's really neat. Looking back over your time as a farmer, what is one decision you look at now as having had a very positive impact on your farm?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure there was really one thing. That question stumped me. I think maybe the first one, the first biggest one. So when I came home from university, I mean, of course, all bookkeeping was done by hand. You're writing everything out. In 1980, the computer at Guelph was a building.
Yeah.
Right? We're still doing chip cards. But in 1983, I think we purchased a 386 computer. We had a veterinary who was a really good vet, did the work for Romandale and some big herds, but he was also a computer geek. And he got us started. We bought a 386 computer with a printer and a screen for $5,000. Like, and everybody said, what? You got enough power? You got enough power to last 20 years, they told us. I said, what are you doing? Why are you buying something so big? And we learned, my dad was, you know, only 42 at the time. He learned, we went to OMAP and took lessons on how to write DOS and work with Lotus and learn how to, we made a flat-based database program that we could start to computerize our records for the cows. That maybe initially, in terms of record keeping and tracking what we were doing, we signed up with CanFarm and changed our accounting program, recorded our, a lot of our farm information. So initially, probably the next one was more labor-saving things because we're doing little square bills, slugging your ass off from all, seemed like all summer. We switched from small bales to round bales. And I still remember, well, I'll name him because he doesn't think so now, but Lauren Ellis said, you'll never make as good a hay as you did with little square bales. And I said, well, we can't have a little square baler and a forage harvester and a round baler. We're going to try and we're going to cut down the amount of work and hard labor that we could do. And it was a big one because we learned how to weed. We made good hay. Eventually, we would go to baleage when the baleage came along. But switching to round bale, because it was the time. One of the things we don't measure well enough on the farm, I think, is the amount of time it takes to do certain jobs. And if you can save that time, it gives you more time to think, more time to do jobs that you like doing, maybe. And, tractor, it's still work and it's still long days. But if you can save some time by making and do this and make the same kind of feed, then, that's a good thing. The next step would have been the TMR was a life in terms of production and the way our cows produced. That was a big one changing. And I never believed that I didn't think I wanted to eat porridge all day long. And that was kind of my take on it, because I always thought that variety was kind of, but once you see it, get a well-balanced TMR, you go, now I get it. That one mouthful, all the nutrients, the things that are supposed to happen, the balance, the creating, stomach mat. We had a really good nutritionist who helped us along the way. And we could change. We didn't feed the same thing all the time. We were a haylage base. We only had one silo, so we didn't use corn silage. So we worked with that. Well, in terms of production, that was the biggest leap ahead. And then the last couple of things were cow comfort. Tunnel ventilation was huge in the old barns because it was so stinking hot on days like this that being able to move the air through there when you do it. And I remember going to Brian Brighton at the time for a visit and going, wow, is it ever nice in here? And they were still in the old barn back then. And I went home to Dad and I said, we got to do this. They were doing it in the States. Brighton was the first one to do it up here. And we bought four big 48-inch fans, put them into the barn, and the cows just loved it. And then we changed. We went from 60 stalls down to 50 stalls, made our stalls, went from 48-inch stalls to 52 wide. Oh. We couldn't make them longer, put mattresses in, made our cows, put chains on, got rid of the heavy head rail, and hooked the chain, logging chain up and chains, and give our cows more freedom. And that was kind of the next step in cow comfort and where cows didn't go out, but the ability for them to turn their head and lay, and that was Dr. Neil Anderson came and we did the measurements on lunge space and rocking and the things that the work that he did and use that to make. So those are kind of all in progression things that were important to us as we progressed.
So if you look back, is there one instance where you might have, realized that you had some egg on your face and said, this is going to be a learning experience here?
Well, I think, every time you do something, I mean, you pivot. And I will say that we'd start on something that, maybe that wasn't something, we'd change our minds on things. Once you've invested in something, you're kind of committed in terms of the dollar wise. I think that we probably changed the way we met. I mean, the round bales were a learning curve to start with. That was a big one because going from, and how we handled them and we started with a pull cart and graduated to a power cart because it was just, they were just tough to pull and size and dealing with, loader tractors and things. So there was, we adapted and how you stored them. I guess I didn't say anything. We also went, I remember going to calf hutches. That was a big one, getting our calves out of the barn. Some of that was space related. We didn't have the barn was 40 by 100 and we put an addition on. There wasn't room for the number of animals we were having in the barns. So we went to calf hutches outside, which from terms of our calf and heifer health. And then we put them under cover and went, wow, that's even better. So few things that you tweak along the way. You start down a path and say, yeah, you know what? I think I can make this better. A lot of the ideas that I was going to say, I don't think there's any necessarily new ideas, but we picked, when we went to visit, my eyes were always open. Like again, I use Brighton because that was a couple of things there, but other farms, when we try to get out and do those farm tours, and if you can come home with one thing, say, huh, never thought of that. Or, you know, wow, I really like that. How could I adapt it to the way I do things? You may not do it exactly like they do, but you bring it and make it your own. You make it your own. Everybody says, oh, you were so smart. Said, well, no, I really wasn't. I picked somebody else's brain. And I have always said, and my dad too, that our farm was just everybody else's ideas brought together in a different way.
When we talk about your herd, you guys had a high level of success on the production side, but on the genetic side as well. So I want to know a little bit about how you approached your breeding management. Did you guys have a mating guide, or did you pick all of your own bulls and which cows to put them on? And what are some of the best sires that you had over the years?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, with the generational gap, and I was, you know, so there were 20 years between my dad and I. I mean, he grew up in some hard times. And we, like, back when I said, like, he knew that Jersey cows had to milk more, and our cows had to milk more to pay the bills. And I, of course, with the friends that I had, wanted to go to shows and be, you know, have type cows. So there was always a tug of war. It's not a tug of war, but a back and forth. That balance, that created the balance that we had. In the end, that's what made us, you know, and we would have great long discussions about, well, no, that bull, well, he don't milk, you can't use them. And I would say, well, there's not enough type there. And in the end, I think what the philosophy we come up with was that our cows had to pay the bills, but they had to have enough type to support that. If you're going to have cows milking 10, 11, 12, 13,000 kilograms, then you darn well better have good udders and feet and leg, and have a frame, wide muzzles, wide chests. So we developed a cow kind of melding the two of them together that could sustain, you know, that had solid type. And you get the odd show one out of that when you do that, and also could do it pretty easily in terms of the level of production that we wanted to maintain. Always looking at it back and forth. I'm a big believer in a generation of type back to a production bull. And sometimes you got to give up one something to get the other. I would look at mating programs. We always got the reports and I would glance over them. But for the most part, we were with milking 50 to 60 cows. We could make individual decisions. I was always looking for that thing that could make that cow better. What does she need? One or two traits. I didn't try to overthink it. So I wasn't, you know, and certain bulls could do that. Back in the day, small side story. So when I was fieldman, World Jersey Conference was coming to Canada, 1982. Grant Butcher was chairman here in 1982. It was in Ontario. And I was just kind of ending my term as field person. And I remember going to Jack White and buying 20 doses of Valley Stream Silver Beacon. The very first dose of Silver Beacon we used was Rexley Beacon Herta, 92-point cow, 10-star brood cow, the dam of Hannah, Hostess, all of those cows. It was the very first used on a bright spot cow that my brother had shown, as only ever had one calf, showed as a 4-H calf, and won at Markham as a calf, and only ever had one calf. It was an 83-point bright spot, but a nice cow, really nice cow, milked well, but Herta was that mating from that original Silver Beacon. So we had Silver Beacon put a lot of milk and fat into our cows originally, but they had their issues. I mean, you needed center ligament was always going to be an issue with them in terms of where they were at. So we recognized that, and we came back with Jody's Imperial Serval, JFD title, Metal on Bright Spot. So those three are pretty big. You will find them in probably 90% of the pet. You go back into any of our pedigrees, you're going to find a lot of that Canadian pedigrees. Back in the day, Beauty Doris Master, my dad had used him and had quite a few of them. We had some failures along the way, but you put those bulls together and you will find them back in a lot of pedigrees. So a good foundation. Part of it was there wasn't a lot of choice. those were the, that was it. I mean, pick those bulls and use them. Silver Beacon was a private sire. Jack marketed him privately, so he wasn't part of the unit system. So that was a step outside the box to do that, to step into that. So, but it did kind of set us on the way with that, with Turtle on the way and back and used back on. And we had, you know, those old cow families that my grandpa had used, always AI. There was a bull, but he was only ever used for cleanup. So it was always AI services. And again, looking for more production as well along the way. And then after that, probably Perimeter came along and again, he was a test sire mating on a Doris Master cow back in, you know, that back into that kind of family and our high family, which goes all the way back to the original cows. And Perimeter Iola happened. And again, she was another once in a lifetime cow. And out of her image and idea and, you know, and all of the other the I family that's come along and prospered, you know, from behind that. So it's a little bit like a snowball. Once you get it rolling, then it's easier to keep, you know, it gets bigger as you go. I won't say it was a brainstorm. It was just kind of one of those things that happened. Could have done something else and gone a different direction, but it worked.
Do you have a favorite cow or maybe two cows that, you know, you look back at your time, you're like, oh man, that if I could bring one cow back and put her in my barn today, this would be her.
I mean, Iola for me was a nice, I mean, her and Hostess was always, you know, and she gets a lot of the accolades and people still talk about the Hostess family. Part of it was that she had so many daughters. We did some flushing, was a lot. And in terms of what she did, she was not, she had weak pasterns and she had them as a 2-year-old. They never got any worse. She was 20 years old when she passed away. Like, I mean, as far as that went. But for me, I was always an Iola fan because she was a cow. Like, she went to this T-Mex Walk of Fame. She had more show side to her, and her daughters, there was more, I guess, potential for sales from showier kind of cows. Those two are our namesakes and pretty prolific. Iola was, I guess, 6 when we lost her a little earlier than I wanted. I think there could have been a lot. We could have got a lot more. If I had one back, that was the one I wanted back. And it was just one of those things. That's what happened to good cows sometimes, you know. So, but those two, yeah, they, and when we had Herta, Dad said, we got a once in a lifetime cow. And she was special. She was number one LPI cow. Her daughters, Hannah and Hostess, were 1 and 3 LPI cows. Like it was also the time when the Brazil market was big. We made a lot of money off of those cows from what we had. And they, so in terms of what they did for us and making us leap ahead, like it was, we went from taking baby steps to making huge strides in terms of the level of our herd. We were selling a lot of cows, but we were also improving at a, you know, our genetic rate was improving great as well. So kind of a double thing. We were putting money in the bank and yet we were making the herd better as well. So, yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot of name cows there.
It's been 2 years since you've sold the cows. Do you miss it?
Yeah. You know, I do miss the cows, but I can always go visit them. I don't miss the work. My shoulders and knees and my dad's shoulders and knees and where we were here, our time had kind of run out. We were surrounded. The neighboring renting places we had were senior. One of them, one of them has been sold and the other one, you know, really, I could see we were going to get in a bind and I wanted to head that off. We were in COVID, remember? Like we were stuck in the middle of it. And it's like, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? And I said to my dad was still, I mean, he's 85 and still working a 60-hour week. And yeah. I figured I was working 80 to 90. I hadn't missed a milking in a year and a half. And my knees and shoulders were telling me I was tired. And my body was tired. So that part of it, it was more, you know, the herd was great and I knew it was. And I wanted to maximize that. And you know, I don't know whether share is the right word because I'm not sure what, but it was more, you know, we need to do this when we can. And yes, it was COVID. It's like everybody, how are you going to sell them in COVID? And so what I did was I put together a spreadsheet, talked to Jennifer and Andrew at Emily and said, let's see what happens. We'll put I put together a price list that I thought was reasonable. They weren't cheap, but they weren't expensive. And I priced 140 head with a spreadsheet and said, here, what do you think? We sold within the first 2 weeks, we had sold 30. Some heifers, a couple of high-end cows. One of them's Stony Brook Avonlea Heb, that's that 89-point Vivaldi. And her dapper, there was a few of those early high listers, and I thought, okay, it's going to take a little longer. And then I got a call from Olivier Marquis that he had a friend that was looking for a Jersey herd, and that's the Belle Flam story. So Simon and Olivier had bought 10 head from me when he started, 10 of his original cows. So that's Du Ceylon, where came from here. Him and Maria Christina drove here all one night to see the cows, and then drove home and bought 10 head. And so then he came back with Simon on that in COVID. They had to get out of Quebec because they couldn't drive. They couldn't be out at night. They had to be out of Quebec by 5 at night, remember? And they drove all night, three of them, and Cedric and Simon and Olivia. They landed in at 5 in the morning. Solomon was broke. TMR was broke. And they walked around and looked at the cows while I milked them, went out and looked and walked up to me and said, we'll take them all, the milk cows. And I went, what? And hence they took 50 milk cows and a few heifers at that time. And the deal was that they would move. That was March. They were still milking 50 Holsteins in a tie stall barn. They went home and ripped their barn out turned it into free stalls and put in a DeLaval robot. And our cows landed in there in June, walked off the truck, went to the water and walked up and started eating and never looked back.
Well,
from a tie stall, to a freestall situation with a robot, just like Jerseys do, walked in and made themselves at home. And I didn't get to the meeting this year, but now they have two robots. So they took an entire Holstein herd, sold it all, and they had a pretty good Holstein herd. It was a 260 BCA Holstein herd, sold a red cow for 10 grand when they sold their Holsteins, and totally converted to Jerseys in 3 months.
Wow.
So, I mean, if that ain't a Jersey success story, I don't know what is. And they are not unlike you, Eric. They have, I think maybe 5 kids. I think they just had another one now. I think they've got 5 young guys under 10 or 9 to 10 down to and little guys. And they're involved in the community. They're both well-educated. I just love them. They're so enthusiastic. And I am so proud of the way our cows have accentuated into their herd and the way they've taken them. They haven't. Not all of them, but I mean, because they took old cows. They took everything except for a few high Somatic cell cows that we had. They had a little calf last year that was an honorable mention All-Canadian 4-H that their little daughter showed. And they're so excited. So, they're busy. And that's been an exciting story. My dad and mom are so excited for them. And that makes the transition with that. And a lot of the other ones, I mean, the heifers, we had an online sale. And they've gone all over the place from the States to, to here, there, and everywhere. And there's cows. We've got a bunch in Manitoba at Nick Ishenmood, is it? Sunny Dairy. And there's a Boonstopple out there that's got some Rexleys. And probably every couple of weeks, I'll get a email message or, this cow went very good or this cow went excellent or she just had a heifer calf. So I get updates and it's 2 years and I'm still getting that kind of information.
Well, that sounds great. And I think that speaks to the quality of the cows that you guys had. And I think that's a tribute to the work that you and your family put in over, over 100 years, 1912. That's 109 years worth of labor to get there. Right. Cher, so you're working at Jersey Canada now as a fieldman. Maybe give us a brief impression as to what you do and how much you like it and how it's going.
Well, I have a couple of part-time jobs, so that's one of them. I'm kind of the Central Ontario rep, which isn't as much of a growth area as maybe East and West. So working with Nick Groot covers West and Mike Bowles is covering the East. So I mean, if someone has an issue, and that can be anything from management, calf feeding, to genetics. I've had a couple of calls. I actually, probably the biggest number of calls have been, you know, what should I breed my cows to? I want, and my first question is a question back is, what are your goals? What do you want to achieve? Do you want, you know, are you about, I mean, and I always come back to my experience in that, you know, if you want high production cows, then you need to make sure that, you know, they can support that, and let them make those decisions. Cause I think you need to be comfortable with your own decisions, but my job is to offer options, things that I've seen from my experience, one from our own experience, things that I've seen on other farms. Cause I, you know, I do visit other farms, and I mean, we know that the dairy world has changed. I mean, there's lots and lots of robots, and it requires a different kind of cow than maybe we had in the past in terms of her serviceability and reliability. So those kind of things are, you know, it comes down to individuals and what they're important. If there's assistance for registrations or transfers, I can do that as well. I've helped out at a few of the shows, not a lot, but if they need somebody, I can run a mic or marshal cows, or I, you know what, I'll be honest, Eric, I just love hanging around cow people, dairy farm people. I love to visit. I do. I love talking farming, you know, and I still, like, I'm always going to be a farmer, even though that's not what I do every day. Mind you, one of my other jobs this week was hauling hay, and I'm driving a discbine and hauling hay for a local feed mill. They do a bunch of custom hay. So when nobody wants to see you do a field visit in June because yeah. You're doing other things. So I do that. And then except just don't call me on a day when I'm golfing, which might be once or twice a week. I do some golfing and I enjoy that. I'm not very good at it, but I do enjoy doing some golfing. And in the wintertime, I curl. I'm at the curling club every day that ends in a Y. That's the other part of my life. I like to volunteer. And so I'm vice president of our local curling club. I'm the volunteer coordinator. You know, I just auctioned at the local Lions golf tournament. I was their auctioneer. And I have always believed in community service, you know, locally and otherwise. I mean, that's why I was on the Jersey on Canada board for, you know, I believe you have to give back and for everything, you know, everything that comes to you, you know, you should give back and then some. So, we're, you know, Sue and I are both the junior farmer training in us makes us want to be one of those, you know, and give back.
It's obvious from our conversation here that you still have the enthusiasm. It, you know, it's just bubbling right up to the surface there. And I think that's great. Before we wrap up, what is one piece of advice that you might share with young farmers that you think we don't hear often enough?
Well, I thought about that one too, and it's probably going to seem, you know, maybe a little simple, but I think believing in yourself, I've often said, and I'll say it to, I used to say it to for my 4-H presentations, is the only bad question is the one you don't ask. You need to ask questions and then take it and make those thoughts your own, you know, and believe in yourself. But learn from those others. I learned from the Brian Sales, Frank Stingers, Grant Butchers. You know, did I believe they did everything the way I would do it? No, but I learned from them in terms of the way they, you know, treat people, the way they analyze things and then use it. Because change is going to happen. It's a different time. Like when I started with computers being the way they are, I mean, now that's a given. I mean, everybody, like, your phone will hold more than the computer, you know, than the building that was at Guelph back in the 80s. But and that's going to change again. I mean, in terms of where that's going. So that ability to use that information and apply it to what you need to do, but believe in your own thought process. And yes, as you said earlier, changes may happen, but don't be afraid to pivot. Don't be stubborn, be open-minded, and don't be afraid to believe in yourself and change if you need to.
Larry, this has been a really great talk. I'm so glad that you were able to join us. Thank you for sharing a little bit of your life story and your family in general. And I hope that you continue to enjoy the quote unquote retired life. And what are we, 5 days from your next golf game?
Yeah, probably it's going to rain for 3 or 4 days. But no, it's my pleasure, and everything is about balance, whether it's family or whether it's cows or whether it's your farm. We all need to work in balance and you know, and find what's comfortable for ourselves. There's no right or wrong way. There's just different ways.
This has been great, Larry. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that's all for this month. Please rate, review, and share the program if you liked it. Next month, I hope to be joined by Dr. Christine Bays, Chair of the Department of Animal Biosciences at Guelph University. Cows moo, cows poo. They pay the bills and are full of thrills. So long for now.